Oh my god, there's a third season of A Certain Magical Index? Fuck everything. Oh, why do they keep making this shit?
I don't know, man. I've never seen any of it, so I couldn't tell you.
It's really bad. Ugh.
You know what else is really bad?
Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and with me today is Duncan.
Hey there.
Jeff.
Yellow.
And John.
Hello.
We've actually been doing like a bit of soft talking warm-up, so someone else is going to take over the transition into anime for me.
I don't watch anime anymore.
Why not, John? Don't you like anime?
No.
Cool. Cool. Good podcast.
But I like anime. I've been watching a show that's currently airing, unlike y'all.
I mean, I'm watching a show. I don't have anything to say about it, but I will once you start talking, because that's like my problem when it comes to this podcast.
Well, I have been watching Wotakoi, Love is Hard for Otaku. We talked about this last week. A couple of last episodes, I've appreciated it. So far, the show has been very lightweight, just kind of like reference humor and like a couple of, like, you know, pretty basic relationship gags, but, you know, they're starting to get more into, like, the inner life of the characters, especially Hirotaka, who is the stoic gamer otaku boyfriend opposite Narumi Momose, the more manic Fujoshi office girl who's trying desperately to have a relationship where she doesn't get blown up for liking boy love magazines.
So what's happened in the last couple episodes for our listeners who aren't as on the cutting edge of anime as us?
They've had more of a focus on Hirotaka. They've gone into his past a little bit, and they had sort of, at the beginning of the show, you know, they had kind of been using Narumi as the perspective character. You know, she runs into her old friend, he's kind of like, oh hey, how you doing, and you and you sort of get the impression that, like, you know, he's sort of moved on, but he's like excited to see his friend, and they just kind of like start dating as out of convenience. But then you start realizing that he's had a thing for her his whole life, and a lot of his sort of gamerdom is him sort of running away from the feelings of like loneliness and regret that he was never able to, you know, seal the deal with her in his earlier life. And now it's him sort of feeling, you know, dealing with this feeling of inadequacy and regret in his current relationship with her, which is why he keeps like holding back from her. He keeps feeling like, you know, oh, she's matured, she's grown up, I'm still this little kid who's just playing video games, and I don't know how to be better than that.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, it's also interesting because in the first episode, she like makes a joke how she'd like never date him because she didn't want to lose like one of her like nerdy gaming friends, and then literally 6 to 8 hours later in the fictional time scale, he like says like, why don't we date, and she said yeah. And so he's got these inadequacies also built in that like she's only dating him because she just, it's too much work to pretend to be someone else for a guy like she had in the past.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like that's a, you know, again, you know, it kind of like, what was that show called? The Candy Girl show.
Why am I so Degashikashi?
Degashikashi, like, you know, a show that starts off like very light and fluffy, suddenly like giving you feels. It was, you know, it was kind of surprising, and I appreciate it, even though they keep doing the thing in relationship anime where they just like keep, you know, they make the first kiss like the, you know, the holy grail that will just end the series if it ever actually happens.
Yeah, that's got me super frustrated. I broadly enjoyed the last two episodes, but they literally even like tease that they're going for the kiss and he hugs her instead.
Yeah.
And maybe there's an intent there to be like, oh, it's like a more sincere, companionable expression of affection, but like, no, just, she's your girlfriend, she's been your girlfriend for like 4 months.
Yeah,
like, who does that who's not like 14. Sorry for all you late bloomers out there. If that's your thing.
I was annoyed at it for doing that, for being a complete wind-up merchant and just going, they're going to kiss, going to kiss. Nope, they're not.
That was also like, you know, him still feeling like, you know, I'm not ready for this. I'm still a little kid. And the fact that he does a thing that a 14-year-old would do kind of plays into that, and which is why, you know, me projecting my, you know, high expectations on a thing that probably doesn't deserve it, but who knows? They'll see.
I mean, there are, like, we seriously need to come up with, like, a list of anime where the kiss is the beginning rather than the end, because I think that is a lot of people who invest a lot of time in romance anime tend to eventually crave, like, people being, even if they're not adults. See, that's why I keep bringing up Kari Kano, because even though it's kids, and even though there's a lot of, like, high drama, like, you either love me or you hate me, there is still, like, they kiss in, like, the second or third episode, and then they have a relationship beyond that. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Ori Monogatari does that.
Does porn count?
I was going to say, crossing the boundary between those two is our sort of favorite love-hate anime, which is Scum's Wish.
Well, Scum's Wish, it's funny because I actually, when you bring that up, yes, I think of it as a romance anime because it's actually about, like, the consequences of love and the thin line between love and hate and between, like, joy and pain. But it definitely, I think it's meant to be something a little bit more, like, trashy and tabloidy, which is funny because, I don't know, I'm just tired of, like, super duper chaste anime relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they're, like, less threatening to the hypothetical nerdy otaku out there who, like, hates a girl as dirty if she's sullied by physical affection. But still, like, these people are in their 20s. They should have kissed by now.
Yeah.
I think it was nice in Watakoi when in the one of the most recent episodes that they sort of shifted Hirotaka's most vulnerable moment back to a flashback, which mm-hmm. is when he's put in an earring to try and impress Harumi, and he's sort of put it in, and he's like, oh, it just didn't hurt, but why am I doing this? And he's like, okay, I'll take it out. And then it cuts to, okay, 10 minutes later, it's stuck, it's hurting, he's crying. And it's like... It's like any teenager who's ever done something to impress and messed up.
And also, like, one of the first things that she notices when they reunite is, oh, you had your ears pierced at some point.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and he explains this, like, I wanted to grow up, and I wanted to be somebody. And that is, like, the good part of this arc is that, like, oh, he wanted to be somebody so that she would notice him.
And she acknowledges... is that she's actually realized that about him, that maybe he actually did that for her, because she makes a comment like, she, one of the things she likes about him is that he when he tries hard to grow up, and gives him a pair of earrings. And so it's like she's obviously decided that there's, or got an idea of that he was trying to, that what, well, one thing she likes about him is how sincere he is about how when he tries to change himself.
Yeah, yeah, and it's funny because Narumi's been broadly portrayed as almost the most self-involved of all the four main characters. Where she, like, well, they go on a date to a amusement park, and Hirotaka brings along a piggy bank and charges her 500 yen, which is $5. Every time they, like, say something nerdy, which is actually probably, like, one of the funnier bits in the show so far, when they have the argument about whether, like, Pokemon Go is nerdy.
Yeah.
And she's like, what? Like, everyone plays Pokemon Go. And he's like, the only people still playing it are nerds. And she's like, okay. Oh, no, it's vice versa.
Yeah.
He says, like, Pokemon Go is nerdy. She's like, the only people still playing it are nerds. But, yeah, it was funny to, like, see her, like, basically have to get outside of herself. And the fact that she's doing that is almost... These are two people who are actually kind of really interior, basically realizing that the other person is there and that they need to... You build a bridge from both sides. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've been enjoying. I just wish they would have kissed.
Yeah.
build a bridge of spit from both sides. And it's kind of a bummer because, like, the other relationship with What's-His-Face and Glasses Girl, yeah. Kabakura and Koyanagi.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the way that they've kind of broadly set them up as like a long couple that's very comfortable with themselves as a counterpoint to this new couple that doesn't really know each other, even though they're longtime friends, is really interesting. Because there's that great bit where Hirotaka's like, how are you guys like when you're alone? Because they all have these like showy, like very dramatic fights all the time in public. And he's like, do you guys do this when you're alone? And like, no, we just like hang out. And it's just like, oh, so yeah, there is like a public versus a private presentation. I think that actually is a tool that Hirotaka uses later to process his relationship with Narumi.
Yeah, because obviously what his response is that we're no different in public and private, and he sort of realizes that means that they're not really letting their guard down.
Yeah, yeah, no. That was the best moment, because I did think, like, man, these people fight a lot for people who've been dating for, like, a decade.
Yeah. I was also surprised that they don't live together after a decade.
I think that might be like less common in Japan. Mm. I don't like our Japan expert John can volunteer.
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely an expert on real life Japanese relationships and how they work.
You've lived there, which is more than any of us can say. So
yep, I did live there alone.
I think you. So there you go. There you go. No, I think you don't move in together until you are like
until you
engaged
kiss.
At least or married or yes until you kiss although to their credit they've I mean it's presumably the other couple's kissed, so
yeah. Well, and yeah, and he's like, oh, you should stay over tonight. And she's like, I just need to stop at my place real quick first.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to where it's going, but I don't know if it's... I think at this point, yeah, it's going to end with them kissing and resolving to try harder in their relationship, which is kind of a bummer, because...
Yeah.
Like I said, like, the underwear comment in, like, the second or third episode, maybe be like, oh boy, it's going to be about how, like, non-virginal celibate cartoon characters. It's going to be about, like, the real experience of dating as an office worker and a nerd in Japan, and it kind of is... Like, the externalities are the same, but the internalities aren't.
Yeah.
I take comfort in the idea that almost certainly somewhere out there, there's a H-Dojin, which makes all our pontificating about why don't they irrelevant.
That's too much they kissing, though, Duncan.
I mean, that's why I brought up porn, and I was only half-joking. There's a lot of hentai, I believe, that people tell me that it's like, oh, that tells good stories. I mean, I don't...
Well,
I always remember like seeked it out, but I don't know.
Yeah, I always remember, and I think it's like one of Patrick Galbraith's books, The Otaku Encyclopedia or something. He has an interview with the like private, like the secret identity guy who's the organizer of Kamiket. And he has this really great thing about like, why do people make doujin? And he's like, well, because our favorite works are imperfect ones that let our minds take up the torch after it's been set down. And then hilariously says, like, you never see a doujin of an American in Paris because it's a perfect work and there's nothing to, like, build on there, which I always thought was funny because it's never occurred to me that American in Paris is a perfect movie. But yeah, he's like, no, so, like, if there's like, a critical mass of flaws where there's enough flaws that, like, there's a place to insert yourself and be like, well, when they're not on camera, they're doing this or they're doing that, and after the story ends, they'll be doing this. But not so many flaws that you're just like, this is a big pile of shit. So I've always thought of that whenever there's clear failings in otherwise enjoyable anime, is that like, this is a space for both hentai and non-hentai doujin.
So what you're saying is that all the people out there currently shipping lippin with his current antagonist, there's probably a doujin out there doing that for them.
I'll check during the break, but I 100% bet there is some very yaoi about Lupin and what's his name?
Antagonist, because you mean Jigen?
Jigen,
he's not an antagonist.
Jeff linked a huge Twitter thread about someone looking at the whole history of Lupin and saying that him and Jigen have a really, really a bit more than a bromance. and
that, or at least like there are people who work on it that make it very easy to read that. Like there was a specific director who had done a bunch of episodes in the second series, or part two, I should say, that also worked on Legend of the Galactic Heroes, which is another big sort of vein that they mine for sort of like queer readings of anime. And, you know, just like the way that he like frames them and the way that it's directed, that it's very easy to read that as representation, if, even if it's not necessarily explicit.
Well, it comes, as that thread said, it comes from a tradition of kabuki where there are coded words and positions that indicate certain levels of homosexual or at least bisexual expression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read it too, but also then I later read that the words that Jigen uses are not associated with that anymore. It's more like a historical thing and not a present day thing.
Yeah, so, and yeah, that person, Ela Simmons, I'll just she is also a host on a JoJo's Bizarre Adventure like close read podcast that has a very heavy like queer reading of those, and to their credit, they do their homework. They make a very, very compelling case. I'll send links in the show notes. I like that show. I recommend people check it out if they like JoJo's.
The latest Lupin, Owlbear, his main antagonist, is I think the closest they can come to making him explicitly gay without having a kiss on camera. He's greeted in his bedroom by a man who's then sort of confirmed as his lover by his staff, and who Lupin impersonates to steal something from him. So I think that's about as close as you can get without them actually having a kiss on camera. And it's nice for him just to be a good villain and not hamming it up, and just like, his entire thing is he's just as smart, just as capable as Lupin, except he's working for the cops. Yeah, and as a long con.
Those evil cops.
Yeah.
So you've actually like been consuming a lot of Lupin, because in addition to the currently airing show, you watched the Miyazaki the movie, the famous movie that involved Miyazaki, The Castle of Cagliostro, right?
Mm. Yeah. It came on to, just out of nowhere, came on to Netflix, and I hadn't seen it for ages, so I thought, oh, well, why not? Because when I saw it at first, it was a very bad, I'm not sure if it was VHS or if it was just a bad rip, but it was like 10, 15 Laserdisc. Years ago.
Laserdisc.
And now, watching it on a big screen with a nice transfer, seemingly, it's interesting to see how wonky's not quite the right word, but how imperfect a lot of the animation was then compared to the modern series. Like watching the modern Lupin on the same day and looking at just how perfect every line is, and then going back and watching even this revered studio's attempt at it, and all these lines which are all a little bit wonky, all a bit imperfect, and faces deforming, and in the ways that you see people picking holes in modern anime, saying, oh, this animation was terrible, look how their face completely bent out of shape in this scene, and yet...
Oh yeah, not staying on model is the greatest sin these days for an animation anime.
They were doing it so much in this show. It's like, it happens all the time, and it's like...
Well, but also the movie was a lot more wacky and cartoony than Lupin usually is.
Well, it's like the...
You gotta make a point, John. Make a point.
Okay, so the pink jacket episode in the recent series, that was still really clean, even though that was really wacky.
Well, that's also because it's not hand-drawn, right?
So I mean, if you have computers making sure that you stay, like, on model, then it's a lot easier to do. It's a different process these days.
Is the new Lupin completely 3D?
No, but it's just when it's different to hand. It's, think about the difference of tracing over a line on a computer to tracing it by hand.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's just far easier to get a perfect transition from one drawing to another than it used to be. That said, I know we're saying like, oh, the old Lupin was more wacky than the new Lupin. There's actually a fairly high body count in both of them. He's not afraid of killing people, and people a lot of the time try and kill him.
Sure, but it's about the overall tone, not the actions that take place, right? Like, you drop an anvil on somebody's head, they die to that. That's different from shooting him in the face and laughing.
Is it, John?
I mean, I don't know. I've never done either. I could try it, but you know.
It's good.
I dropped an anvil on a man just to see him die.
So did you find... Was it nice to be able to see, like, Lupin 30 years ago versus Lupin now? Is there, like, a nice contrast or continuity?
In Castle Cagliostro, he's a lot more heroic than he usually is. Like, that movie is kind of off-tone for what Lupin was back then, and I feel like I've read interviews where Miyazaki acknowledges that, too. I mean, he's still Lupin, but he's a lot more...
Can you just run down the plot of Castle of Cagliostro real quick? Just...
Do you want me or John to do it, or both?
You do it, because you watched it recently.
Okay, so... Lupin has just robbed a casino with... and he's driving away with all his ill-gotten gains, the entire... Their little... Is it a Fiat they have? I'm not sure what their car is. They have this tiny little car.
Small Italian car.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's filled to the brims with banknotes. And Jingen's there sort of like tossing the notes around and going, ah, ha, ha, we're rich. And then Lupin just picks up one of them and goes, His face drops and it's, oh, they're forgeries. And so he says, okay, just chuck them out the car. And so you see him chucking them out. And it's, okay. So the entire rest of the film's about them finding where these forgeries are made and how it dovetails with this princess who's been abducted by someone else to get married to make their claim to the throne of Cagliostro legitimate. And it's just basically a rescue caper rather than a heist caper, except she's, as they keep bringing up, she's what he's stealing, and it's all about him trying to steal the bride away. And it's about them breaking into the castle, getting chased by the Count's guards, breaking back out, trying to figure out how to get her out of there. Fujiko making a appearance and being as badass as always. I love her outfit in this. She's got proper combat fatigue. She's wearing like a maid's outfit. She just throws it off and she's got a combat fatigues and a Kalashnikov. And it's like, where did that gun come from? Who knows? But but she's like there fighting off the guards and chucking the occasional grenade their way with a badass look in her eyes. But yeah, it's as I say, it's... Its main subversion is it changes stealing some item to rescuing a person. It's not hugely different in the methods he employs or the stuff he does, but that choice of what he's stealing is what gives him this more heroic attitude in the film. And they invent some flashback reason for why he feels a particular need to help this person, but it's just shoehorned in at the end and it doesn't particularly make a difference. He's more just being a gentleman thief.
Mm-hmm. He's more of a gentleman than usual.
Yeah. He still calls Fujiko Fuji Cakes, which is something I think John's commented about that, which is interesting about them in the recent series, is that they're now sort of estranged and he's not flirting with her in the same way he used to.
Mm-hmm. Is Fuji Cakes just the way they translate Fuji-chan? Yes.
Fujiko-chan. Yeah.
Okay.
It's terrible. I hate it. I want to die every time I see it.
Just keep the honorifics is my policy 99% of the time. But
yeah, don't translate the puns. Don't translate the honorifics.
No. Just the people who get it will get it, and the people who don't won't care.
And they'll pick it up over time. It's not like people are incapable of learning anyway.
No, people come out of the womb liking what they like, John. You can't change that.
You could make a case that a movie is a one-off, and so they don't have someone. You can't guarantee someone's going to come in and see it and have seen it before. Well,
were you watching the English dub or the subtitle?
Subtitle.
Yeah, then fucking get used to it.
Watch it again. Watch it again.
If you're going to dub something, sure, because at that point you're no longer maintaining the fucking.
Well, it's also like translation versus localization and.
Yeah, I mean,
we could have this conversation forever.
Yeah, all I'm saying is people know what the word sensei means. They can figure out honorifics over time, too.
Don't censor it, Seth.
So what you're saying, John, is that like an anime which was just released as a dub would be like essentially worthless.
I don't like dubs, so, you know.
There are a couple good dubs, but overall, they tend to... I don't know, the habit, especially in like the 90s and 2000s, of making matching mouth flaps the goal as opposed to making matching like the sense of, I don't know. Like we brought up Angel Cop before, and that also like they just decided that it was going to be like this hardcore like bloody drama, so they just like inserted like a metric fuck ton of swearing to...
Well, that was all dubs in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was like the thing that like people didn't want to read, and there is an argument to be made that like if you have to read the subtitles, then you can't be looking at the art. But nevertheless, I don't know. There's like a few good dubs, like the Ghost in the Shell standalone complex dub, Trigun, Cowboy Bebop. I guess there's not many.
Yeah, it would have been really tragic if people had passed over Angel Cup because they didn't want to read.
They didn't know the real. They didn't get to read the real anti-Semitic rants that were in there.
Yeah, my actual point with bringing up Dubs is that like once you dub something, you're removing that layer of illusion that you're watching a foreign film or foreign TV series. You know what I mean? So,
which is important to some people.
It's important to some, but my point is like at that point you can get rid of the honorifics because, well, one, you're speaking in a different language, and two, people are no longer expecting to watch a Japanese film with English subtitles. They're now watching an English film, not for real, but effectively. So if you're gonna watch subs, just fucking learn. You're already like Fuji cakes.
I mean, the worst of both worlds, we can agree, is when it's dubbed but they keep the honorifics. It's like Sakura-chan. What? Yes, are you doing?
That is the worst.
Okay. Well, speaking of difficulties of translation, I have also been watching anime with one foot in the past and one foot in the future because, to actually flash back a bit, on April 1st, April Fool's Day, Toonami, Cartoon Network, released the first episode of Fooly Cooly Alternative, the Fooly Cooly sequel / reboot that is airing in September on their channel. And then on June 2nd, they released the first episode of the second series, Fooly Cooly Progressive. And I've watched both of those, and I have lots of feelings about them. So when we heard about Fooly Cooly getting a sequel, I think we actually talked about it on our Fooly Cooly podcast like 2 years ago.
Yep.
Or something.
That's about what it was announced.
Episode 6.
Yeah, episode 6. Only 6 episodes. One of our greats in terms of naming the podcast episode. But we had this kind of apprehension that they would either do one of two things. They would either just steal the aesthetics and make some random ass show, or they would just retell Fooly Cooly with different characters for in place of Naota and Minami and so on and so forth. And I'm here to tell you that these two shows take both of those routes, and one of them is very good and one of them is not good. I was talking with Jeff a bit beforehand, so we're gonna pantomime out our reactions. Fooly Cooly Alternative is great. It's amazing. It is, I would say, the best case scenario for a Fooly Cooly sequel. Fooly Cooly Progressive is tedious and on the nose and trying too hard and thinks it's way smarter than it actually is. And unfortunately, we have to wait a long time for Fooly Cooly Alternative to reach our shores. And then meanwhile, we have Fooly Cooly Progressive. These both star young girls who are kind of withdrawn and socially ostracized. And the representation of those is they wear headphones. Fully Progressive opens with this girl having a dream that she's in this destroyed world where she's rotting, and then a big eye opens in the side of a mountain, looks at her, and she transforms into a robot and punches away a bunch of giant irons, like the meta medical mechanica iron in the original Fooly Cooly. And then she wakes up and she's emotionless and she hates her mom and she's bored in class and her teacher is kind of weird and talking nonsense. And then she gets hit by a car driven by this dark-skinned, white-haired woman who you've probably seen if you've seen any of the trailers. And something comes out of her head and, yeah, and then the weird teacher reveals herself to be Haruko. And they fight a big monster in a junkyard, and that's it. And it's not good. It's really boring and tedious. And, like, introducing, like, Haruko but white hair is dumb. And, like, this character has no texture. I feel like they saw Naota from the first Fooly Cooly and how he was kind of, like, withdrawn because he was depressed and stuff. And they're like, oh, we should have an emotionless character who is, like, disconnected with her mom, who... It broadly seems from her comments that maybe she's waiting for her father or possibly who might be a space alien to return. The girl's father, the mother's husband or boyfriend or partner or whatever.
So like Space Patrol Iluka.
Yeah, kind of. I don't know. It seems like it's really overpacked where like the white haired lady whose name is, I don't know. Jinyu drives like a very like big tail fin Chevy Bel Air, and she's got a guitar, and Haruka's there, and she's got her Vespa and a guitar, and it's just kind of like, why? Like why'd you make like it, it? It has nothing to say about like being a kid or anything.
Are they doing the Star Wars thing where like Obi-Wan Kenobi was wearing those robes because that's what you wear on a desert planet, and then in the prequel, 15 years later, every Jedi wears that and that just becomes their uniform?
No, I think it's kind of like cargo cult anime where you just like you received Fooly Cooly on a desert island and you're like, ah, this is how anime is. You must have like the weird girl in a vintage vehicle from out of town who's carrying a musical instrument, and you've got to have like a kid who's unhappy and a parent who doesn't get it and a teacher who's weird and over her head. And like I like the surprise that like the teacher like literally like starts ranting about like it's time to grow up and like ride on two wheels instead of four. And then she just like rips off her mask and it's Haruko, and that's like the end of the show. And like that was like the only good part. But God, it was long and not good. As opposed to Fooly Cooly Alternative, which I watched after a few beers one night and like this is amazing. But then I like refused to admit that to myself, and I watched it again literally like 2 hours ago, and it's still great. The girl is, again, like, kind of isolated from the world, but she's 17, and she's really afraid of, like, not having an identity as an adult, but she's got these friends who kind of, like, support her in her childishness, and it's them hanging out, and it's very much kind of slice of lifey, but weird. They, like, decide to build, like, a soda bottle rocket where you, like, pump it full of air, and then it shoots off, and then it gets destroyed by a giant Google Map pin falling from the sky before they can launch it, and the Google Map pin like transforms a like crossing guard statue into a monster, and Haruko hits what's her face in the head, and informs her that she's working for like the space police now, like she's actually like not a rebel anymore, and a flower grows out of her head and turns into a guitar. But then it like cuts back to she's like, you can't be 17 forever, so it's important to be 17 now, and they like launch the rocket. It's like nice. It's like actually like a show about adulthood and like how terrifying it is to be at the end of your teens and not really knowing that you're actually scared of that and thinking that you're like worried or stressed about other things. I don't know.
It's also kind of like interesting. Actually, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. I had nothing else to say. I was just going to talk in circles.
Okay. I was just going to say it's actually kind of an interesting next step, because the original Fooly Cooly was about the transition from adolescence into being a teen.
Yeah. So yeah. No, and there is like it does see, because I looked this up and I'm like, okay, well, these are both production IG. They got the rights from Gainax, and they're doing the thing that they did with Ghost in the Shell Arise, where they like give it to really young staff and like let them make their name on like a big established property. And so I looked and I'm like, oh, the lead director is Motohiro Katsuyuki, who we know as the guy who directed the first season of Psycho Pass and the Psycho Pass movie and Adam the Beginning, but otherwise is not that experienced. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, if it's the same guy doing the direction, maybe it's the same guy it's a different guy doing the writing, and these are different scripts. It's rarely how it is in anime. Like, usually the scripts, but no, it's some guy named Awai Hidato who's only ever done this in terms of anime. So I actually saw that, like, the episode directors, there is one episode director listed, and he's the guy who did isekai baby Hitler anime, John?
What the fuck would I know?
You're talking about Tanya the Evil.
Yes, Tanya the Evil. I was like, oh,
just
so
I'm going to know every trash isekai out there. Well, I mean,
because you had like a feud with that anime for a while, I feel like, because people kept bringing it up and you kept being like, shut up.
Yeah, you're right. I do remember that, because everyone was talking about how great it was. And I was just like, no, leave me alone. Stop it. It's not good.
So he's listed as the episode director for Alternative. And also this one's done, I think they outsourced a lot of the animation. It's not just Production IG. It's Nut. We've talked about Nut before, and RevoRoot, while the other one is entirely in-house and it has a different episode director for every single episode. And none of them have particularly very much experience, but I really wonder if it's just like, they got lucky and they gave one show to a guy that has chops and the other show to a guy that doesn't. Because, I mean, I'm honestly just stunned at how different they are. Like, one of them is exactly my nightmare of what Fooly Cooly could turn out to be. And the other one, like, makes me excited for November. Unfortunately, we only get them in dubs until someone manages to pirate the Japanese version. Because that's part of the licensing deal. And the dubs aren't great. Speaking of Sakura-chan and stuff like that.
I don't know. Is that how they did? They just like went straight translation and left all the honorifics and.
No, but it is definitely just like it's a nerds dub as opposed to like a popular dub. Because I think that I think what they're hoping to do is capture the original audience that went crazy for Fooly Cooly originally during the midnight block. But yeah, I don't know. I'm excited to see what happens next. I'm going to be very grudgingly watching Fooly Cooly Progressive, which I think I said this before, but it's interesting that like Fooly Cooly Progressive is the one that's got no ideas and Fooly Cooly Alternative is the one that kind of just keeps within the series themes. It feels like it should be vice versa almost. But yeah, I don't know. I'm interested to see where it's going because like I had only apprehension for this series. But I recommend go right now to your favorite torrent site and find the leaked Fooly Cooly alternative episode, because I think it's actually great. It's like Kaon meets Fooly Cooly in a good way, with something to actually say about like growing up and maturity, and that like, oh, it's not just accepting that you're growing up that solves problems in life. There's actually like just a never-ending series of problems and letdowns that you overcome with your friends or by yourself. Either way. Cool. Well, do we want to take a break and then talk about our spotlight, Trava Fist Planet?
Yes.
Let's do that.
Sure.
Cool. And we're back. For the second half of our podcast, we'll be covering our spotlight anime, Trava Fist Planet, a 4-episode OVA that aired in 2002, directed by Ishii Katsuhiro and Koike Takeshi. Jeff, you pitched this anime, so why don't you tell us about it?
Well, Trava Fist Planet is about two space dirtbag war vets who are looking for easy money to fund their mech boxing team, which is what the Fist Planet subtitle is, and really that's the only time it really plays anything into the show. On their way to a job that's supposed to be some easy money, they find a escape pod with an amnesiac lady inside who decides to tag along because it's like, oh, we're just going to a planet and it's not going to be too intense. And it turns out that this planet is like the last refuge of these like intelligent war robots that nearly destroyed the universe. And they meet up with a bunch of legendary space pirates to do battle with these robots. And it's just about them sort of being completely out of their depth and desperately trying to keep their head above water. And yeah, that's the basic plot of it. It's the same director as Redline, and it technically takes place in the same universe as Redline. I think these characters actually show up as in a cameo as well.
Mm-hmm. At the fish restaurant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And mostly the show is an exercise in style, and I enjoyed it. In the same way that I enjoyed a lot of, you know, speaking of the midnight block of animation that you'd saw a lot of in the late 90s, early 2000s, like this kind of reminded me of that sort of style. Like it has sort of like an animation festival kind of vibe to it, whereas everything is the dialogue is all very kind of like naturalistic, but also, you know, sort of survives its weird sci-fi trappings, I find, you know, and they really kind of like hang their hat on it being like dumb sci-fi stuff when they start getting into like the more, you know, quote unquote serious parts. So it was fun. It was mostly just fun. And that's why I wanted to pitch it.
Well, why'd you pick it then, Duncan? And what do you think of Trava Fist Planet?
So I had seen it before Jeff pitched it, and my main memory of it was the art design, these very bright, quite often primary colors, and coupled with like pure black shadow and just this very stark style to it. And I mean, visually it's still a very enjoyable if rough experience, although I'm not sure it has anything much of a plot. This feels like a really long short to me, if that makes any sense.
Well, it is. It was, when it says it was made by Madhouse and Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a short film anthology series kind of umbrella. So yeah, it's like it was meant to air with a bunch of other like incubator experimental stuff.
Yeah. And it is like 45 minutes in total. So it is kind of short.
Okay, well, it's shorter than a film, longer than an episode, and it's sort of in this weird spot where it knows it doesn't really have far anywhere to go, but it doesn't really make any attempt to go anywhere either. It's sort of like with a full-length film, you normally have an arc to follow, a big goal, some sort of resolution at the end. Whereas in a normal episode of a series, it's all within the context of something larger. This is neither. It doesn't have any larger context apart from something which... So they obviously had no idea they would ever use these characters again. And mm-hmm. They don't really resolve anything within it either. Its plot's really strange because it's like you say, they're two people who just sort of doing their jobs, trying to get on with whatever they're doing within their life, and this drama they find themselves in is just like a hassle to them. They don't particularly like think of themselves as heroic people. They just want to get out of there and get on with their job again.
Mm-hmm. In the third or fourth episode of the, you know, the four little mini episodes, they do encounter this, like, you know, a proper anime hero in his like cool mech doing the cool, like, you know, kaiju battling moves, and he's like, he speaks all heroically, and he's just kind of like dragging them along, you know, basically under duress. And, you know, it kind of, like I was saying, like, it kind of, like, hangs its hat on the fact that, like, you know, these are two guys who are just, they're just there to make a buck, and they don't really care about all of the grand heroics, but they just kind of, like, go along for the ride.
I do wonder, though, because he was in the military, and he was, like, he claims to have been their best pilot and then was kicked out for being too good, which like they don't really undermine that statement, but it's just hard to believe on the face of it.
It's almost like Kelly's Heroes, but with Oddball as the main character. It's like this.
I'm old enough to get that reference. I know what you're talking about.
I get it too. I watched that when I was like sick and home from elementary school.
I don't get it.
That's your loss.
It's a World War II heist movie. It's actually pretty good. I recommend you looking it up. Starring Donald Sutherland and Clint Eastwood.
It's from the era. It's from like the supercast era where like Magnificent Seven, Great Escape, where they just have like a million like extremely well-known actors all in an ensemble piece.
But none of the actors in Treva Fist Planet are well-known.
No, and I'm not surprised because they both are very annoying. God. The two main characters are extreme. Like, their dynamic is absolutely aggravating. And my biggest complaint about this is how much time we're forced to spend with, like, two argumentative idiots.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the Red Line franchise.
Yeah, I wanted to like it, but I didn't. The problem with it is that I like the story. Like, it's my kind of story. Like, it's just about these idiots in space doing some bullshit, and then they get dragged into some other bullshit, and they just deal with it and then get out and move on. That's my, like, that appeals to me a lot, especially in sci-fi settings. But the voice acting just rubbed me wrong every fucking time they opened, especially the fucking monkey dude. I don't know what he was. The dude with the ears. I hated him. I would have rather read this as a comic, because then I wouldn't have had to deal with the voices, and I also didn't think the animation was that great, even if I liked the style most of the time.
It was very, very disjointed. It had moments. It certainly has dynamism to it, but it's certainly not smooth and doesn't have, as we were talking earlier, of how sort of hand-drawn stuff from the earlier doesn't really have this frame-to-frame continuity. This is very much a good example of stuff where that isn't particularly cared about.
Yeah, and I kind of like the voice performances. I don't know why. I was charmed by it in ways that you guys weren't. But I also appreciated the fact that it was short, because I definitely think, because like I like Redline on paper, but I don't know if I've ever actually watched it through in one sitting, because I find that movie kind of exhausting.
Oh, I love Redline. I watched it through in one sitting happily. I can understand where you're coming from with the voices, because they do feel a lot less theatric, I guess, than theatrical, you know, most anime, I guess, where they tend to overplay emotions and all that shit, like get real melodramatic. So it feels a lot more natural, sort of, except that it's just like sometimes the recording quality feels like it was really shit, like it was really amateurishly recorded. Like, you know, some you might hear on a podcast called Keyframes.
I quite like
not in the past few episodes where there's been a different editor, though.
That's true. They've been...
I quite like the voice of the their amnesiac princess companion. It didn't fit what you expected them to characterize with her. It's just like this really quite softly spoken voice, and that she's sort of portrayed as this very, well, to say she's like hourglass wasted is a contradiction, because it's like goes to like a pencil and then goes back out.
They acknowledge, because I was expecting that was just the art style, is that everyone's got like weird shoulder to waist to hip ratios, but then like the monkey guy does say like, hey man, she had really wide hips, so it's like,
is human, which is like worth pointing out. Like, everybody is like a weird alien, which, you know, could hurt and could help your ability to take like the weird, like you were saying, like just inhuman proportions that a lot of the characters end up having.
Yeah.
The guy with the weird reptile head had the most human-like proportions for his body.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good.
It's like his head's like a mix between a duck and an armored
fish thing.
Yeah,
he was like some kind of like...
He's a weird... I like his head. I like his
weird crustacean.
I love that he's got this like telescopic eye.
Yeah, that just
sort of pops out.
There's no regard to like logistics or physics of like where is all that stuff going when it's inside his head.
At one point, he loses it, and it's just still there. It just like falls out, and then there's just another one in, and there's still. It's pretty good. I like it. I like his head. Everything they do with his head is good.
Yeah.
I like the way that they eat stuff in this, and in Redline as well. There's they make it so often in science fiction, the alien food is just either like comically ugly, like oh it's got weird tentacles and stuff, or it's just look boring. Whereas this just looks genuinely strange. Like they're making tea at one point, and he just chucks in this like. They're like almost like little jellyfish or something, and they sort of sink down, and you have all the bubbles rising up in this strange green liquid. And he's just like, but he's treating it perfectly, like it's perfectly routine. He's just sitting there, letting it brew away, checking it, sitting down, stirring it, and it's and there's this point where they're eating, and is it Shinkai?
Shinkai
is the turtle guy.
Yeah, he's sort of like half chewing what looks like an alien from. It's like this. He's got his friends like eating what looks like some sort of deep sea vent worm, and he's eating this like weird scaly carapace thing, and just sort of like chewing on it, and. It's like quite nice seeing them just like treating this really weird exotic food as normal, which is is something which I think in a lot of things doesn't happen. Like it's like oh look how weird this is and how strange it is, and they're just like yeah what the hell, we're just gonna eat this stuff.
Yeah. What do you think about they? It was funny how there are four episodes, but they're four parts of one episode, technically speaking. And they definitely set it up like this is the first episode of a series where like we'll see you at Fist Planet, the giant like heroic
space knight elf guy.
Was like oh I'm competing too. What do you think about the pretense that this is like the first episode in a series?
I just saw that as like a framing device, like they're consciously making it as like a tribute and like a homage to these sorts of series, and it's like this is always what the first episode of something's like.
Yeah, I think it also might have been like the flash forward and at the end of Flowers of Evil of like, you know, we'll be very open to doing more of this, you know, get out there.
I didn't get
instead we got years of working on Redline and just like it being a ruinously expensive project.
Yeah. I mean, Redline isn't that. I mean, if you replace robot fighting with robot race with weird car racing, it's not that the two plots they're suggesting aren't that dissimilar. So maybe they just pitched it and they said, "Oh, well, why don't you just do racing instead?" And he was like, "Sure."
Yeah, could be for a long time while watching this, it's been a long time since I've seen Redline. So I was like, this is leading up to Redline, I'm pretty sure, because I knew it was a prequel-ish thing. But I couldn't remember them actually having, like, fighting at any point in the race. I knew it was a race, but I thought, hey, maybe it's a fighting race, but no, it's not. I guess it's just a completely different thing.
I think it was kind of a Mario Kart race, a speed racer, has, like, weapons on their cars, but mostly it's about the race.
Yeah, there was no guy with a big fist punching people, I think.
There was Machine Head who was sort of doing that, and who was whoever the character designer is has a talent for doing generally interesting alien design. Something in common between this and Redline, where you have like aliens which actually don't look like just humans with different color skin.
Yeah. Yeah, visually interesting and inventive in general.
That's like, but unfortunately kind of a trifle also. So
yeah.
I quite liked I have a fondness for some sort of late 80s, early 90s cyberpunk anime like Dirty Pair is my particular favorite, and they have this style of doing UI for their stuff, which I think this riffed on a bit, where you have like these really strong because obviously it's the animation style as a whole is very much one of strong contrasts. And so when they do these made up UIs, you have these brilliant reds and yellows and strong shapes, and it's modern user interface stuff is all so smooth, so transparent, so thin lines. And these are just big, chunky displays with big, chunky shapes. And I just like it quite a lot.
Cool. Well, I think that might be it.
Yeah, I think we did it.
Woo. Cool. Well, for our next episode, we'll all be pitching and Jeff will be choosing. And we'll probably have more to say about... We managed to go an episode without talking about Gun Gale Online, so I'm proud of us for that, at least. Yeah. All right. Well, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at KeyframesPod. Email us questions, keyframespodcast@gmail.com. And, of course, tell a friend. Say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye.